is changing at a remarkable pace. International relations, the stuff of foreign policy and economic policy, seem sometimes to be playing on entirely new playing fields. On this edition of Conversations, we look to a European perspective. I'm Susan McGuinness. Please join me in welcoming Danish Consul General Lasse Reimann. Lasse, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Glad to be back here, Susan.
We have lots of possibilities for our discussion today. I thought we might start with the stuff of foreign policy, and with this question. With the fall of communism, there is a great pull, a great inclination to dismantle nuclear stockpiles, to withdraw armies from places around the world, especially for the United States, and to reduce those armies. On the other hand, there is a fear somewhere in the back of our heads saying, what if a new tyrant arises? What if the world goes into crisis again and we're not prepared? As you stand back and look at international relations, what do you think about the possibility of World War III?
Well, that's certainly a good question. I think you're right in saying that we are in a new situation, that we are in one of these periods where history takes a leap. We've seen a couple of these in this century, I would say. The finish of the Second World War and what happened after that was certainly a leap in history. Mm. And you could also say that the First World War and the breaking up of the order of Europe and the world before then was also a leap. The risk of a third World War is, of course, today greatly reduced. And it has to do with the fact that the communist empire, so evil empire, has crumbled. It doesn't eliminate risks, though. I think it leaves us with a number of risks, but you could say that the niveau of risks globally has lowered. But it has also regionally increased.
Yes.
And it has also increased in the sense that we all know that there are nuclear capabilities in the former Soviet Union which now have nowhere sort of to be, and that these capabilities, be it weapons or be it scientists, are, you could say, in a sense, free to go. And this means that the risk of spreading of nuclear technologies and also nuclear weapons is higher than when we had the tough confrontation between two global superpowers.
Mm-hmm. And transforming in ways that we may not understand. We may look to Korea as a new nuclear threat, Northern Korea.
Yes.
But we also may look, and this is something I've just begun to read about, at the possibility of drug lords as mm-hmm. a new nuclear threat. Mm-hmm. These threats don't take massive armies or massive stockpiles. In your estimation, what do they take?
Well, that's true. They do not. And this is the new confrontation that we have to meet. The demands, you could say, for large armies, for large armament, for the whole race of armaments is now decreasing. So what we have to do now, and in particular in the only superpower in the world, United States, is to rethink what are our strategic needs and goals, and how are we going to meet these challenges that you allude to, challenges that may arise from smaller powers or even not even powers, but, as you say, drug lords or terrorists or others. How can we meet them and take their challenge up early as possible? How do we frame our strategy and how do we frame our international cooperation in that regard? That's certainly something that has to be done as a foreign policy challenge in the years to come. We have already started on it.
Mm-hmm. You have, it seems to me, a strong orientation to group negotiation. You have talked in the past couple of years when I've listened to you lecture about the rise of the common market emerging into the European community. Can you address issues of international security from a group perspective? Mm-hmm. How do you feel we need to work together? Because I know you do feel we need to work together to respond to problems around the world.
Yes, I think it's very, you could say, I would say it's rather visible in regard to the transatlantic relationship. Mm. Of course, there we always worked as in an alliance under the umbrella of NATO. The question that arises now is, how do we keep NATO as a relevant mechanism for security and military purposes in that rapidly changing world? It's obvious now that that NATO has been a success, that the Warsaw Pact has been dissolved, that the Soviet Empire has crumbled, and everything that NATO was created for, you may say, has now evaporated. But we certainly still have security needs in Europe. And this means that we have to redefine the role of NATO so that it meets the security needs of the new Europe. And how do we do that? And I think a very important step was taken just about a month ago at the NATO meeting in Brussels, where the American proposal called a Partnership for Peace was adopted. The idea of this proposal is exactly to modernize NATO to the modern needs of Europe and to extend NATO as a negotiating framework for the former Warsaw Pact countries. And doing that in a flexible and balanced way so that we bring everyone to the table and everyone feel that they have something to contribute and gain, and that we do not exclude anyone and certainly not exclude Russia, and thereby running the risk of getting Russia on the wrong side of us.
When you talk about including everyone, you're turning to the East, aren't you?
This
is the Eastern non-aligned countries that have been released from the Soviet Union.
Yes, I'm talking about, in particular, the Eastern European and the Central European countries, who are now in a situation, you may say, where they have regained their independence, but they are sort of free-floating. Mm-hmm. Their own ally, the Soviet Union, has disintegrated. Their old market, the Russia now, is not able to buy and to barter in the same way as she was before. And they desperately want to bring about market-oriented economies as we know them in the West. And this means that they will have to market, become competitive and market into the West. So that's on the trade and e-commerce side. In security terms, they are also in a vacuum. Mm. Their own old security structure with the Warsaw Pact is gone. Russia is still there as a mighty power to the East. And in the West, where they want to have the closer alliance, they see NATO. And they desperately want to get closer into the framework of NATO. And the NATO countries have invited them to do so, and also Russia. But very importantly, in a flexible way where you create a framework for negotiations which would then gradually bring these countries closer into the NATO partnership.
Yeah. With us today on Conversations, Lasse Rimmen. He is the Danish Consul General to the United States. There are 13 states which are Lasse's jurisdiction, so to speak, all of the western states of the United States, those on the coast and those on the immediate interior. This is Conversations. We're taking a look today at global change from a European perspective. Tell me what's at that table. If NATO is opening windows and doors, so to speak, to the East, what is it inviting those countries to discuss?
Yes, I think that's another good question, because the way that it has been formulated in the Partnership for Peace proposal, which is a United States idea, is that it is a framework for negotiation, meaning that you could practically take any topic and discuss it. It doesn't limit, you don't have to limit yourself to military or security topics. You can take almost any topic, and you can discuss it in that framework.
This is like the Helsinki Accords of 75?
Yes, 75 Helsinki was exactly. What we did then was to create a framework for a forum, you could say, a permanent diplomatic conference almost, in which you could discuss political issues, economic issues, and human rights issues. And this was why the Warsaw Pact then agreed to do this, was because they got recognition for the Eastern European glacis or the boundaries of these countries in the Eastern Europe, including then Eastern Germany. That was the political gain for the Soviet Union then. The gain for the West was that we opened a framework of negotiations on other issues, not only the economic ones, but also the human rights ones. And as we now today look in the rearview mirror, we can see how important it was to have a negotiating forum where you could bring in almost any topic, including human rights, liberties, democratic principles and values and all this, and what that meant for the opposition movements in the then communist-ruled Eastern European countries. I think we see here a clear contribution to the breakdown of communism from within, with the rising understanding of what human rights and democratic principles are all about.
Staying with this for a minute, NATO's Partnership for Peace isn't, well, it doesn't seem in 1994 to be as remarkable an event as the creation of the Helsinki Accords, but do you have great optimism for its potential?
Yes, I think it's very remarkable in the sense that it is a clear signal that the NATO countries have the ability and the political will to challenge the new Europe, that they don't stay within the known framework of the NATO cooperation, but that they have the will and also the political desire, you could say, to revise NATO so it becomes a viable organization in meeting the challenges of the post-Cold War Europe. So I would say the decision about a month ago in NATO, if it maps out the guidelines and the strategies for NATO in regards to its place in Europe, mm-hmm. and still with the transatlantic dimension in it, which is very important, and in doing so, maps out maybe the strategy for the next generation or generations.
What's the relationship of an organization like NATO in this kind of post-protectionist age to the United Nations, which fights the same battles differently?
Yes, yes. I think there we are also in a situation where we seem to be breaking new ground. The illustration of this, I think, is in the conflict in former Yugoslavia and Bosnia. It is very important, I think, first and foremost, that whatever happens there, that there is a clear understanding and a consent between the within the NATO framework. It would be very unfortunate, to my perspective at least, if we did not have a complete understanding among the NATO countries at what needs to be done. That's a precondition. Well, when that has been established, then I think it's equally important that whatever we do with the consent or even under the instruction of the Secretary General of the United Nations. That is also what is in the resolutions, etc. But we should always bear in mind that we are, whatever we do in a conflict of this nature, it is certainly to the advantage of the solving the conflict that we act in accordance with the desire and even the instruction of the Secretary General of the United Nations.
Just to break in for a minute, this issue of what needs to be done is in no way clear, is it?
No, it's not clear. I'm no real expert on it, but I think history shows that in this particular corner of Europe, conflict has been raging for centuries. Mm. It's the old delimitation between the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. It runs into when the Turks invaded, you could say, that part of Europe and went as far as Vienna and then were pushed back. And you see in the book of Gilas, a well-known Yugoslav author, in his book The Bridge Over Drina, which is about 20, almost 30 years old now, you see there that he describes this century-old conflict. So what we're having today, said a little squarely, is nothing abnormal that we do have fighting going on there. I think we might, again a little squarely, say that the abnormal period was when we did not have fighting. Mm. But this doesn't excuse us for not trying to help out and solve the problem. But we should also be realistic and see it as a very intricate problem. And I think there also, because of the complexity of it, it is very important that we act in unison between the major powers and under the NATO and UN framework.
Mm-hmm. One more question about Bosnia. And I guess Bosnia is just exemplary of other places where fires burn around the world. I'm not sure whether to ask this or not, because this asks for wisdom you may want to push aside.
Okay.
But are there situations where the world may just have to watch horrors happen as time goes on? We have watched in Bosnia attacks on civilians, the elderly, women, and children, and the world literally recoils from them.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, we feel helpless. If there is no direct solution, do we have to just watch sometimes?
I think, on my personal note, I think, yes, I think we'll have to sometimes. And I think present history and past history shows that. You could say the inability of a collective reaction to safeguard human rights in corners of the world, that inability to do that is demonstrated. We have tried to do something in Somalia, haven't we?
Mm.
But there, did we succeed, or aren't they back or almost back to where they were? Although we are continuing, which is the right thing to do, but we are up against situations which are often very complex and which are not very easily dealt with, and in which you might say that it is really not often military power that does it.
Mm.
It's sometimes if we start in completely other end of things, in improving, for instance, the conditions and the economic conditions of some of these countries, then I think we might be helping much better than we would by just doing it in a military way.
Mm. On this edition of Conversations, Lasse Rimmen, he is the Danish Consul General to the United States. The 13 states which center his jurisdiction are Alaska, Arizona, California. He is based in Los Angeles, Colorado, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, New Mexico. You've noticed this is in alphabetical order. Oregon, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. Lasse Rimmen was appointed to the position of Consul General after many years serving the Danish government in 1991. This is Conversations. We're talking in some ways about a phrase that you have talked about in lectures I've heard, and that is supranationalism.
Yes.
where we as nations work together to solve specific problems or to make general agreements.
Mm-hmm.
I think I want to talk specifically about supranationalism, especially in the area of economics. But can you define for people who aren't familiar with this term what that is to you?
Yes, it's a new mechanism which was introduced basically in the first years after the Second World War. Europe, being in disarray and very concerned about rebuilding, was put on the road to rebuilding by the Marshall Plan.
Mm-hmm.
And having set Europe's reconstruction in motion, the European powers felt that they were now in a situation where they should start to arrange themselves in the reconstruction. So the important economic injection that the Marshall Plan meant for the European countries then was the inspiration for seeing how could the post-war European countries cooperate, and in particular, how could they cooperate in order to avoid a situation again which would in Europe lead to a Third World War. Now, the vision here was that instead of keeping the former enemy out, you brought the former enemy in and sat him down at the table with you.
In this case, Germany.
And this meant Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an invitation extended to Germany by former adversary France and others to come in and sit at the table. And what was meant by that was that these countries, there were six in all, France, Germany, Italy, Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg, what was meant was that by bringing together their policy-making capacities and decision-making capacities in crucial areas like coal and steel. By doing that, you would prevent the risk of rearmament. So precisely these areas are so important to rearmament, but having Germany at the table, having all six at the table, you would sit then and discuss how to allocate the limited resources within coal and steel in during the reconstruction of Europe. Now, that, of course, meant that you knew what allocations were made to whom.
Mm-hmm.
And it also meant, and this is the obligatory part of this cooperation, that you had given up your own decision-making capacities within these areas, these policy areas, and you have sort of handed them into a pool. And that pool was represented around that table where you made this cooperation work.
Each of the countries got
together.
Each
of the countries got together, and they handed over their sovereignty. And this meaning that once you had agreed, and with the high authority, as it was called then, you had agreed on measures and allocations or whatever it was, then they were directly applicable in the six countries or in whatever country they were directed against. Now, this country could then say, no, 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 we don't want to do this. They were obliged and obligated to do that measure or not to do it or whatever was decided.
So no one could leave the table. We have all committed to the table, so the decisions will be ours.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Right. And so that countries had to respect whatever was decided at that table. So even a big power like France or like Germany or Italy, if they didn't feel that it was entirely to their interest, then they would have to respect it. Or even if they didn't feel that the regulative whatever to be implemented in France or in Germany was entirely to their liking, they could not say, we won't do it, because they had handed over the sovereignty in these particular and very important policy areas.
This is a psychological question that may not quite bear on the international relations in that instance, but did this give Germany its self-respect back? And was that important?
I think it surprised Germany. And if you read the memoirs of the Chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, he doesn't hide how surprised he was to have this kind of offer for cooperation from former adversaries. Remember, Germany had been at war with France, with the Netherlands, with Belgium, with Luxembourg, and finally also with Italy. So they were so surprised to be invited in to the table. And I think it did restore Germany and the self-esteem of Germany. And in particular, when we think of the experience after the First World War, when Germany had to make all these very heavy paybacks after the devastations in the Allied countries, and now she was not asked to do that. On the contrary, she was invited inside, and let's see how we can get a reasonable cooperation going in these crucial areas, and let's see if we can make it a success. And it became a tremendous success.
With the lifting of the Iron Curtain, how does the integration of the former East Germany into this discussion of partnered decision making happen?
Yes. Well, the lifting, of course, of the Iron Curtain meant that the two Germanies were reunited, as we all know, and this meant that now former East Germany became part of the European Union. It did so because it was merged with West Germany, which has been a partner of the European Community ever since its inception.
But these are not equal partners coming in. Eastern Germany is coming in with some hampering forces.
Yes, they are. And there is a tremendous reconstruction, you can say, going on in East Germany. The expense of that is much larger than was initially thought. And I think what has been coming very evident now is that it is not only the expense of it, but it is also the deepness of the problems, which have to do frequently with environmental hazards to a degree which is unheard of in the Western world. One could have thought that the very strict rules of the communist countries would have seen to it that that at least in the environmental side they would have been clean, and they claim to have been so. But it seems that the capitalist economies of Western Europe have been much better in keeping an environment reasonably clean, not totally, but reasonably clean. And now we see these environmental catastrophes, and that, of course, it makes it more difficult to go in there and say, they go in, buy a plant, and recondition it, and then turn out parts for this, that, and the other. Well, if that plant is sitting on an environmental catastrophe, who you become liable, maybe, or how can you make your workers work there when you are used to having higher standards?
Lasse Riemann is with us today on Conversations. A little bit more on Lasse's background. He has served the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs in various capacities since 1974 and carried through to 1991 within the Division of International Law, the Political Department, the Human Rights Division, and then as head of the Division for International Trade Policy from the years 1986 through 1991. As I said, he was appointed Danish Consul General to the Western United States in 1991. Lasse entered the Danish Foreign Service in 1967 after graduation from the University of Copenhagen. On Conversations today, we are taking a look at issues of global change, not necessarily in the environmental sense, but including that.
Yes.
And certainly in areas of political and economic change. You are listening to KUAC, and this is Conversations. Lasse, I want to turn to a question relative to that imbalance, if I can. East Germany and West Germany and issues of pollution, but this is also moving into issues of economy and issues of military relationships. How can we maintain an equal playing field where we all give up a little and gain a little when there are countries so far behind who must come forward so far to us? And this is, of course, in your area of kind of supranationalism, where we give up and we gain together.
Yes, that's true. I think, you know, in Europe, it is becoming more clear to the European people, to the voters, to the politicians, that we in the Western European democracies, we have at our doorstep a problem which is manifold and which has to do with what you alluded to, and which is so close to us that we have to solve it. We have to assist in solving it. You could say that sort of the awareness of these differences in economics, or mostly economics today, that they are now becoming much more aware to the people. And this means that we will have to stretch out a hand. And we are doing that from the European Union countries in getting closer and closer cooperation agreements with the Eastern and Central European countries, and now also with Russia. The design of this is to enhance their own efforts to become market-oriented economies. Mm-hmm. And the preparedness of the Western European democracies to do this, I could illustrate by the fact that a country like Denmark, which has 5.1 million people, that we are now allocating aid, economic assistance and aid, etc., to the Eastern European countries, which would equate, if you from United States gave an aid of $17 billion, you are talking presently of within the range of $2 to $4 billion here in this country, and that's a sizable amount of money.
Yes.
But per capita, a country like Denmark comes up with a figure which would equate about $17 billion. Now, this is done in other European countries too, who contribute very heavily: Germany, the Netherlands, and all the European Union countries. And there is this awareness among the people of the necessity to do this. It's also in our own self-interest, because if they do not succeed in taking off in their new democracies and in their new market-oriented economies, we would probably be facing a situation which would be very discomforting. where they might fall apart, and where you would see people then becoming refugees and knocking on the doors of the Western European democracies. You then could take it a little further and say, what happened to what we know as the third world, all the developing countries? What is going to happen to them? I think the way we are moving now is that we are keeping up everything we can do to help them, but that the reality of it often is that the richer countries do become richer, mm-hmm. and that the poorer countries do become poorer. But we have encouraging signs. We have, of course, the Asian countries who have done very well, the NIC countries who have done extremely well. And I think we're also seeing very encouraging signs in South America these days, in some of the countries, and I think that might spread. And I think the NAFTA agreement, which has clearly wider dimensions than just the three countries of Canada, United States, and Mexico, is a vehicle, could easily be a vehicle, for enhancing the encouraging economic trends that are happening in South America, for instance.
These agreements that may be economically based or militarily based don't just remain in their categories, do they? Because we reach out to areas of pollution or areas of social problems and the
yes.
like each time.
Yes, yes, I think so. I think one of the things that's so interesting now is that you sort of have a little bit change of priorities on the international agenda. As we talked about before, the military question seemed now not to be moving away from total global warfare on the nuclear threshold. And the sort of traditional strategic thinking there is now completely different. We are moving into more regional conflicts and this sort of thing. At the same time, we see how economic issues, now that the nuclear threat has gone, are moving more up the agenda. And I think we see further down the road that other issues that have to do with gaining the technological upper hand is now also there on the horizon, and that the one country or group of countries that gain that technological upper hand will become the leader and the trendsetter in the post-industrial age.
Who do you see emerging?
Several. First and foremost, I think we should certainly keep a close eye on the United States. The United States is the only global power today. It has a strong economy. It seems now even to come out steadily in a rebound, but not dramatically, which I think is fine. It's moving into better waters now. And it has this tradition of openness and of close links between research institutions and businesses, and also government. So we have a very strong base in the United States for a leader in the decade or decades to come. I think there will be challenges, and we are all thinking here, of course, of the Far East under Japanese leadership. Japanese are, as we all know, very clever and have shown that, and they seem to be willing to keep investing highly in high tech, and that's what I think will be a guiding or the leading element in the future of the world would be those who have that leadership. So there will be a challenger there, and there will be a challenger from Europe, and it has to do with the fact that now Europe has moved away from the frozen conditions of the Iron Curtain times. Mm-hmm. We have an open Europe now. The European Union countries are very open between themselves, and they are inviting other countries to join or to come closer. And we have created by that, or are creating by that in Europe, an open environment where you have a mix of various cultural backgrounds, of very scientific skills. And you could say you have a breeding ground in Europe now. It's different from what you have in the United States, but it has that similarity of being multi-ethnic, multicultural. And it could be a challenger to the United States, at least in some areas.
How does that racial and ethnic mix work for power in the beginning of the next century?
Well, I think it's a vehicle, or it's an inspiration for creating coming up with new inventions, for instance, coming up with new ideas. And in my perspective, the ability to constantly come up with new ideas, new products, new inventions in the field of high tech and biotech and information flows and that will determine to a pretty large extent who will be the leader. Think of how United States has been a leader since the Second World War, and think in particular how Southern California or California has been sort of coming up with the trends, have shown the whole world what they should wear, for instance, or not wear, but wear, like Levi's and these things. Now, in the post-industrial age, we'll be looking for very sophisticated products, which everyone will need and will ask for in the rich parts of the world, and then it will trickle down to the second layer and third layer, etc. Now, those who can invent these products, be it within pharmaceuticals or biotech, or be it within food processing, if you can, for instance, create a product which is fat, but you don't get fat, how about that? And the whole world will ask for it, won't they?
Yes.
Now, that company will gain tremendous influence, tremendous power. Now, reinvesting that and going on and creating a new product would be very important.
Well, this is Lasse Ryman with us on this edition of Conversations. Where do you see the greatest weaknesses? What if we're surging forward with the United States, Japan, or certainly the Pacific Rim countries who are at the peak of the technological revolution, and Europe all kind of vying for first and moving backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards as the movement goes on, who's weakest or what aspects are weakest of each national group?
Too early to say, Susan. I wish I could say so, but I think it's too early to say. And it doesn't necessarily have we don't necessarily have to talk about weaknesses. I think we could talk about the relative strength in some areas.
Okay.
I think there could be a division down the road that you would say Japan might be particularly strong in this or that area, and the United States may have some areas where they are particularly strong, and then Europe might have some areas where they are particularly strong. Mm-hmm. So you could have that kind of sort of division. I think the weakness of the development will happen if we can't find sufficient mechanisms that will suffice in that everyone can get into that action. Mm-hmm. That if we, for instance, are going into a period where we would exclude someone who really is entitled to a larger role, I think that would be a problem of tension and could lead to conflict. So that would be important to keep that running smoothly. And I think the other area is that we should always keep in mind that there is this part of the world, large part of the world, that is not entirely in this game, and who will be buying all these things that we would invent in the richer part of the world. And that we should certainly keep them, try and continue to keep them in a flow where they can upgrade their economies, upgrade their standards of living.
And in this issue, you go back to, I would assume, and this is a question, you should forgive me for stating it as a statement, but in this issue, do you not go back to organizations like NATO, which are negotiating with countries who are not there yet?
Yes, that's part of it.
Are there these kinds of negotiations that you see the United States is in or should be in?
Well, that's part of it. I think it becomes a global undertaking with regional aspects in it. I think one of the regional aspects is, of course, that NAFTA is a vehicle really for getting a closer cooperation and bringing up the standards of living of the participants in NAFTA, including Mexico. And as you expand NAFTA, you will bring up other standards of living in other countries. So that's certainly part of it. The global aspect is certainly there. And as we see, for instance, now that the Uruguay round of trade negotiations under GATT have been brought successfully home on December 15 of last year, We now have created a new platform, you could say, for international trade and the way that we can deal with each other in trade issues. And we have also expanded it, because we are not only talking about trade in traditional terms, we're also talking about trade in services, mm-hmm. intellectual property rights. Now we are back to the high-tech world.
Right.
And we are also increasing the dispute settlement mechanisms, and that is avoiding conflict, very important. And then we're also bringing in, and have to look further on, the trade effects of environment, of environmental questions. That's something totally new. So we are having regional mechanisms, but we are supplementing them with global mechanisms, like, for instance, the Uruguay Round result.
So there is NAFTA, the European Community, and above those, there is GATT, the General Agreement
yes.
on Trade and Tariffs. Is GATT the higher authority? Is GATT the court of resolution for world problems in terms of the economy? Do you give it that much authority in your mind?
Well, that's up to the countries themselves. As we work now with international trade questions, we are not giving up our national sovereignty and pooling it like we do in the European Union. We are working together as sovereign states that come to the table as sovereign states and sit down, and then we work out a text, and finally we got a consensus on that. And in that consensus, we invoke, you could say, new mechanisms, which we promise each other to use, and which are typically, for instance, a better dispute settlement system. Say we have a conflict between United States and the European Union countries on a trade, then we do not start our own six-shooters and shoot across the Atlantic against each other. We have agreed that what we'll do is we'll bring it into the framework of international dispute settlement, and then we'll present our case there. I think it's very important to understand that these mechanisms are there to be used, and that if we go the other way, you could say, and start with our six-shooters, then we are departing from the system that we have promised to respect.
Lasse Rimon, once again, is our guest today on Conversations. He has received decorations from his own country of Denmark. He has been knighted. He is a knight first class of the Order of the Dannebrog. Foreign decorations have come from Italy, from Belgium, from Luxembourg, and from the Netherlands. Lasse Rimon is a career-long diplomat. He is what is known as a scholar diplomat. His areas of expertise in study is as well respected as that in politics. Lasse Rimon, our guest today on Conversations. The image of the six-shooter is fairly Western and fairly negative. Guy out on the prairie shoots his opponent. Are there not instances where a nation must separate from the world community and act on its own behalf to say, in the most immediate instance, as the United States is saying in the recent months to Japan, you have insisted on closing your markets while demanding we open ours. We have to take action. In this case, it's unilateral, the United States and Japan. Why is this not good foreign economic policy?
Well, I think we all have sort of have that feeling as you explain it here, that there must be some situations where countries will say, well, now enough is enough, and now we have to go for it, and now we go bashing whoever. And I think that is, of course, a very understandable point of view, and I think it is something which we have, which is in our sort of mental baggage. We have inherited that. We have seen in history countries which felt that now they were pressured too much and now they wanted to go their own way. We have seen that in this century, and we've had two world wars, partly on that certainly. Mm-hmm. We've seen United States also after the First World War closing the door, you could say, to what Woodrow Wilson wanted to do. Basically stepping out of that leadership role which was so evident after the conclusion of the First World War mm-hmm. that United States had. But Wilson couldn't prevail, and so you closed the door. Today, here, as we approach the end of this millennium, I would say the world has grown into a situation or into a circumstances where we are so interlocked that going it your own way doesn't really make any sense because frequently going your own way you will certainly hurt yourself too. You cannot shut the door to the outside world. And the way, for instance, that the trade and the export has grown in the United States clearly show the interdependence that has also come to the United States. And it is, for instance, very encouraging that the very cutting-edge industries in the United States, if you take the high-tech industries on the East Coast and in California, the Seattle region too, they are totally global. They market into a global market, and they do that as if they've done it for forever, but they haven't, because the global trade of the United States was very minimal a generation ago. Now it's growing, and the concept of the global interdependence is coming into the fabric of business, of the business life in the United States. Mm-hmm. So the possibilities of just closing your door or starting the six-shooter is diminishing, because you can shoot yourself in the foot, too.
When, very recently, the United States was, as a country, grappling whether to join the North American Free Trade Act to buy into NAFTA, there was a fear, most frequently expressed by Ross Perot, that we would drain our resources down into Mexico, that we industry would move south, the nation's commerce would begin to shut down, mm-hmm. and that the future was bleak for us. Is this I know I'm asking the naive question, but is this a fear that was specific to the United States, or do you believe that all countries, as we move towards a global environment, which is clearly where you think we're going, mm-hmm. have to go through this trepidation? We must keep our six shooters on when it comes to creating mm-hmm. treaties, and we must not allow other people to melt our borders down. Mm-hmm.
It's certainly a very realistic question, and not naive at all. And I think coming from the European experience, we have gone through phases of free trade agreements and even custom unions, which is what the European Union is all about, mm-hmm. Which has meant essentially what you describe, which is that for instance, the Northern European partners in the European Union, including my own country, Denmark, is certainly in the richer end of the family of 12 European Union countries. And there was skepticism when we went in towards the less rich countries. Wouldn't that mean all that what you said? Mm-hmm. And wouldn't that cost us an awful lot of jobs, etc.? The experience is that it is to the net benefit of all partners. Otherwise, we would not have had the European Union today, had it not been that. So everyone is gaining. But you do have to restructure. You do have to restructure industries which cannot maintain their competitive edge in a large market under a customs union or a free trade area. But that is necessary whether you like it or not, because your competition will come to you anyhow. And it is felt, I think, much harder in this end of the century. The total global competition is felt much harder now than it was at the beginning of the century. So whether you take it through a free trade area or a customs union agreement or none of these, you will get the global competition at your doorstep. Yeah. And this means restructuring, trimming down here and there, and then finding your competitive edges.
I want to approach restructuring from another angle, one that is, to me, interestingly geographic. If NAFTA opens up borders between the United States and Mexico, between the United States and Canada, it's not just opening up borders between countries, but between regions. Mm-hmm. Areas of the southern United States may economically become more aligned with areas of northern Mexico because they'll be working together, they'll be intimate with each other. The same with Canada and the northern United States. What does this do to the nation state? Mm-hmm. I mean, potentially, doesn't it adjust boundaries that are political as well as economic?
Yes, I think it, as you say, you open up to regions, which means that you dismantle the significance of borders. Borders are so many things. They could be passports when you cross as a person, and borders for goods and for services and for information and for culture and for all these things.
Denominations of money.
Money transfers, yeah, etc. Yeah. So basically what you do is that you bring down borders in several of these areas, and maybe eventually in all of the areas, so that you don't need any even a passport to cross. That, of course, opens up a new dimension in the way that people interact on the various sides of these borders. Mm-hmm. And we see that clearly in Europe, where you certainly have tendencies now that businesses will locate, multinationals, for instance, will locate in regions. If you think, for instance, of a United States multinational wanting to go to, say, France a generation ago, they would certainly focus on Paris. Mm-hmm. And they would try to gain a foothold in the French market out of Paris, which was very natural in those days. If the same multinational or another came to France today, they might not look at France as their marketplace. I think they should not. They should look at the whole European Union area as their marketplace. Now, where should they then locate today? Probably in the region where they find the best conditions for their particular product. That could be in Lyon, if we're still in France, but it could also be that they said, no, let's go up to Strasbourg, because here we can reach another host of countries, or go up to Denmark, because there you have the Scandinavian countries and the European Union countries and Eastern European countries. So it's a different game today.
This will be good for Lyon. It might be good for Galveston, Texas, or it might be good for St. Paul, Minnesota, or Vancouver. Or
yes.
But what about this condition we think of as United States, or France, or Canada? Aren't there adjustments then in the self-identity of nations if we begin moving economic and political borders around, or I should say probably more correctly, economic and cultural relationships around?
Yes, I think the traditional status and identity of the nation state may be under some kind of revision in areas of the world.
Is this okay from the global perspective?
Yeah, I think it's all right. I think what we see, for instance, again to go back to the European scene, is that you have increasing regional identities and ethnic identities in Europe today. And that is, you could say, at the expense of the nation state. It doesn't mean that the nation state will not survive. Of course it will. But it just means that the nation state will not any longer be the same total symbol or total parent for all its citizens. It means that other will step in. For instance, the regional council might step in, or businesses might step in and take over part of the role that the nation state formerly had. You see it in the United States too, that regions, the individual states here, are also, I think we are seeing more of a hand in some areas than we have seen before. And I recall, for instance, that President Bush, in his State of the Union message in 1991, he talked about are we in a period now where we have to look at our federal system and to see, do we need to adjust that a little bit? And in taking that up, he was alluding to the fact, should we try to dismantle some of the federal structure and put it out to the states and sort of bring the decision-making down in policy areas? And that's what we're doing in Europe. We are not only, you could say, under the Maastricht Treaty, we're not only having a European level in policy making, which is being increased, new policy areas are brought in, foreign policy is brought in, security policy, and also immigration and legal matters are brought in. Not only are we having a European level, but we are clearly saying to each other that there are certainly policy areas which do not have to go up to the European level, and where you can solve it and decide upon it at the regional level. And that is very important. Part of the integration process is not to make a very strong super structure, the European level. Part of the integration process is also to allow local cultures, local ethnic groups, to have their say, so that you create a superstructure which is strong enough to keep it together, but yet flexible enough to be able to adjust to the needs of various regions, ethnic groups, languages, etc.
This is an insecure time globally. Do you see it that way?
I would say maybe in this way, that we have moved away from the risk of a total nuclear holocaust between superpowers. We have moved away from that, and that's a good thing. On the other hand, we have moved into an area or a period. We moved into a period where the risk of less devastating warfare is showing itself. Bosnia is certainly one example, but we do have other conflicts running around the world today, which we don't hear that much about, but which are clearly there, and we have more coming possibly. So the risk factor is generally lowered, but the amount of conflict that we may see could increase, and they, of course, any conflict has a potential of escalating.
Mm-hmm. More delicate in the future, perhaps.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Lasse Rimon, thank you for a very interesting hour.
Thank you, Susan. Glad to be here.
I'm very glad. We have spent an hour with the Danish Council to the Western United States, Lasse Rimon. I'm Susan McGuinness. This has been Conversations. We've looked today at a changing world. I hope you'll join us again next week, and thanks again for sitting down with us.
Certainly.